The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking levels, adjusting cam, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
Well, Mar-a-Lago hasn't exactly been the Garden of Eden.
That's true.
After all, what have we got here? He took a little loan he had to overdraw.
Some golf.
A beach.
A pool.
A spa.
Someone should have foreclosed on this place years ago.
A bench.
A tree.
What's a ballroom?
Or a boutique.
People who pass through Mar-a-Lago only come here to bribe Trump.
A golden toilet.
Top secret files.
What do we leave? Nothing much. Only Mar-a-Lago. Mar-a-Lago, Mar-a-Lago, undertaxed, overdone. Mar-a-Lago, where else could MAGA plant its feet? Mar-a-Lago, Mar-a-Lago, gaudy and deplorable. Mar-a-Lago, where all the people are effete. Soon we'll see that smirk wiped off his fat orange face. Donald Trump is soon to be displaced from Mar-a-Lago.
Sorry, it ends rather suddenly, and I actually didn't want the video to play the whole time because it's Patrick Fitzgerald, who does a wonderful job with these parodies. He calls himself a poor man's Randy Rainbow. But sometimes when he uses actual movie footage, I get copyright violated, so we don't want that. Anyway, okay, I'm looking to the chat room, the YouTube chat room. How's the audio? Anyone? Bueller, I spent yesterday afternoon, just so you know, tearing this studio apart and rebuilding it. So hopefully it's all working. It looks like I have a streaming bit rate issues again. But what else is new? Thank you. That's a YouTube thing, I believe. Anyway, here we are. Fine. So far, so good. Now, we'll see what happens when Barb McQuaid gets here. And yes, I reconfirmed. So she was supposed to be here a couple of weeks ago, and when she didn't show up in the Zoom room, I realized that I forgot to reconfirm and send them the send them the Zoom link, and so I got taken off the schedule. But today I reconfirmed and we're all set. And she'll be along in about 10 minutes or so and we'll spend the rest of the hour with us. So I'm going to save a lot of the stuff that I might normally talk about for her because we will discuss her book. The book is called Attack from Within. And yes, you see all the stickies. Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. And look, I've said this for years. I really believe it is the propaganda that's taken over and the mode of the propaganda spreading, which is the internet, the rise of the internet, which has done this. Look, I put together this little sounder for Fox Not News years ago, like years and years ago.
Your original source for fake news.
Fox News. We make shit up.
Because they do. They make shit up. And this has been their MO for years. This is their business plan. So what's really disturbing is the fact that, sorry, I see Barb is here and I'm getting her shot set up so that I can bring her in. Sorry, for those who don't know, I do everything myself. I'm the producer, the host, the researcher, the webmaster. And you know what? I'm going to bring Barb down here because so we've been having technical problems for the last few days. It's the gremlins that have invaded my studio. They followed me from Florida to Arizona even. And so yesterday I tore the studio apart and rebuilt it like three times last night, just so you know. I really wanted this to be good today. And of course, there we go. I'm having little issues here, but we'll get Barb up in a second. I got to get this shot set up. Oh my goodness. So anyway, as I told you, the thing that gets me is I really believe the root of much of the predicament we find ourselves in now is the spread of disinformation, which was me. Look, we love the internet. We can't live without the internet. It's sort of like men. You can't live with them. You can't live without them, right? So we need to. I know they say that about women too. It's but we're working on it, right? We're trying to. Come on. All right. I'm gonna bring Barb in because if I try to make this shot perfect, it'll never happen. Barbara McQuaid, it's so nice to meet you. I'm Nicole. Thank you for being here. And I apologize for a couple of weeks ago. I guess I forgot to send along the Zoom link. So, but we're here now. So thank you. Can you hear
me? Thank you, Nicole. Glad to be with you.
Oh, it's good to be with you. And I've got your book here. It's kind of marked up and flagged. But as I was saying when I saw you appear in the Zoom room, the disinformation, misinformation, the on purpose spreading of falsities to push a certain viewpoint is also, yes, it's disinformation. It's propaganda, isn't it? Isn't what we're living through just a propaganda on a wider level?
Yes, I think so. You know, I use the word disinformation because I think it encompasses more than just lies. It also includes things that are misleading or even things that are truthful in an effort to push an agenda.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, whatever you want to call that, but I think it includes a component of deception, of trying to manipulate people by using information as a weapon.
And it is. Now, pardon my ignorance here, but wasn't there at one time a law against propaganda in this country? Or is it just the government can't actively promote falsities, even though they do, but it doesn't apply to media? Yeah.
Well, you know, because of our robust First Amendment in this country, we do have the right to say a lot of things, even a lot of things that aren't true. There are some limits to those things. You know, defamation laws make it unlawful under civil penalty to say false things about a person that might harm their reputation. So that's one area of the law. We are prohibited from communicating threats or communicating fraudulent claims. You know, if our goal is to try to defraud somebody, then we can't say, well, I have a free speech right to say that thing. If you're engaging in fraud, that could be a crime. And then we also have the Federal Trade Commission and some others that try to promote truth in advertising. So advertisers who lie about the properties of the product or something like that could have fines imposed for that. But that leaves a wide swath to engage in, you know, what some people will frame as political speech, political spin. You know, that's certainly one thing. But it's an entirely different thing to talk about things like a stolen election, for example. And if you believe in the theory of Special Counsel Jack Smith, that's a crime because it was an effort to defraud the United States in the fair administration of elections. And so we'll learn whether that prosecution is successful, but it can be very difficult in our society with our cherished First Amendment, and people on the right and the left cherish our First Amendment rights to free speech. It can be very difficult to regulate free speech and decide what is and is not false. And that's what makes it so challenging, I think, in our society.
Right. Most definitely. And we will get to the book because I there's so much in there that is important that people need to hear. But this all relates. So just yesterday, was it just yesterday? I don't know. With so much going on, time gets compressed. But I think it was just yesterday that the judge in one of the cases, in the fraud case, I believe, issued a gag order against Trump, say after he had attacked the judge's wife, and the judge is not off limits. It's like he can still attack the judge, but not his wife and not other. There are certain things he just can't say, regardless of the fact that they're all false, they're all made up, they're all lies. It's his attack. He can still do it on about some people. But then Trump came out this morning and went and attacked his wife again. How can he be held to account for breaking the rules that are set down by the judge?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be interesting to see how the judge enforces this. So first, it's challenging to put together a gag order when you've got someone who is a candidate for president. He certainly has a need and desire, and there's a public interest in having him speak out about issues, including if he thinks he's innocent of these charges, to defend himself. However, the Supreme Court has held that courts have an obligation to ensure that trials are conducted fairly and that extrajudicial statements do not create a distraction from the fair administration of justice. So when you have someone who is targeting a witness or a party or staff or family members and inviting threats and harassment against them, or trying to intimidate what they're going to say at trial, or even creating false impressions in the minds of potential jurors, there is a concern that you are tainting the jury pool or the trial that's going to unfold later. So there is room, and there's Supreme Court case law that says judges not only may impose gag orders, but in some circumstances they should impose gag orders to try to protect this right to a fair trial that belongs to both the defendant and the public. And so we have to think about it in those terms. And so the judge did craft a gag order, imposed it yesterday. This is in the Manhattan DA case that will start trial April 15th. Yes. Involving the payment of hush money to Stormy Daniels. And the judge did have, as you said, left out the judge himself, left out Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg, their fair game, but did say you can't target witnesses, court staff, prosecution staff, family members, or direct other people to do so with intent to affect these proceedings. So it's a little bit hard to prove that intent, I think. But as you say, you know, going after the judge's wife, that's going to be a little difficult to defend against. You know, if Donald Trump wants to get out there and campaign and say these charges are a hoax or that sort of thing, he's permitted to do that. But as you point out, how do you enforce this? Well, ordinarily, when a judge enters an order, the parties must comply with it. And if they fail to comply, what usually happens is first you get a warning. Second, the judge has a couple of options. One is a fine, a financial penalty. You know, every time you violate this, it's going to be this amount of money. That number can escalate. The first offense is $1,000. The second offense is $5,000. The third offense is $10,000. That's one way until you get their attention. And then at some point, the ultimate leverage that the judge has in this case is jail. Someone who is in contempt of a court order can be jailed until they comply with the order. And so that would be the ultimate penalty here. Now, I can imagine again that a judge in a case involving a candidate for president will be very reluctant to jail that person. And I think Donald Trump knows that. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, he might be inclined to really push the limits here.
Oh, without a doubt. And he does it, I think, with such impunity because he's almost daring the judge to enforce it in some way. And then he plays the victim or the martyr. He's got this down to a science. But here's the thing. He's allowed to do that. But over-the-air television is not allowed to lie and call it news, right? Because they're governed by the FCC rules. So a news channel cannot say.
Sarah, you're freezing up a little bit for me.
Yes, I'm sorry. I've had, I told you, the tech gremlins, and they're screwing with me.
Okay, can you now?
You can? Okay, good. If it goes out, hopefully it comes right back. I really apologize. I rebuilt the studio 3 times last night, hoping it would fix the problems. It fixed some of them. But so what I was saying was, over-the-air television is regulated so that a local Fox, local news can't blatantly lie. They can't make stuff up and still call it news. The Fox so-called news channel, that is a cable outlet, is not governed by the FCC. They have more latitude in making, as the thing said, shit up, because they don't have a license, a station license, to be threatened. Where I'm going is, it's almost like cable so-called news has a right to lie and call it news. What I'm trying to say clumsily is that people don't, they have a hard time differentiating. They call it news, it's supposed to be news. And hopefully you're still hearing me. I don't think you are.
You're freezing for me, but I think I know the question you've asked, and I can attempt to answer it. I don't know if it's better for me to turn off my camera. You let me know if you want me to do that. But the difference between cable television and broadcast television is, you're right, in terms of this regulation by the FCC. And so there are some differences in the rules between the two. I would say, however, that it doesn't mean the cable news channels can lie with impunity. As we saw, Fox News did pay a more than $700 million settlement when they were sued by Dominion Voting Systems for airing false claims that Dominion Voting Systems somehow flipped votes from Donald Trump to Joe Biden in 2020. And what that litigation really revealed is, we got to look behind the curtain a little bit, because there was discovery material that was turned over under legal obligations in that case that revealed some of the internal memos and text messages of some of the producers and hosts at Fox News. And we learned that people like Sean Hannity and others said things like, I didn't believe for a minute that these things were true, that the election was stolen, or that these machines were somehow flipping votes. And yet they were willing to air these false claims. There was a little moment of reckoning about a week after paying that settlement. Fox News fired Tucker Carlson.
Right.
And he certainly was someone who was a purveyor of some of these false claims. I thought maybe they had learned their lesson, you know, by paying $700 million. But then just within a few weeks of that settlement, they ran a shot of Joe Biden, and underneath his name, it used the graphic. It said, wannabe dictator prosecuting his political rival.
Right.
there they go. You know, I suppose that's the sort of thing that is more spin than it is fact, and the kind of stuff they can get away with. But it certainly does suggest in the minds of the public that the prosecutions are being done for something other than legitimate reasons.
Right. And because people get their news in such a fractured manner now, you either get it from Fox and the right wing media empire, or you try to seek out real news. There is no left equivalent of Fox. As we learned with MSNBC this week, they're trying to have voices from all sides and present a full picture. For the most part, I think they do. In the case of Ron and McDaniel, were you as shocked as everybody else when you heard about the hire?
Yes.
And the reason, Rachel Maddow did such a great job of explaining why it was so offensive on Monday night. It wasn't just the fact that it was the former RNC chair. It's that she gave the legitimacy of the Republican Party to this wannabe fascist dictator. Otherwise, he probably would have gone down in history like the four that she mentioned at the beginning of her show that have gone on to obscurity, because they didn't have the backing of a major party. That was Ronna McDaniel's doing. She stood by him in all the falsities and all the lies and all the nonsense. And then she went on Meet the Press. Well, that was a whole other thing. But the fact I'm making is, they're trying to bring in all opinions and present all sides of a story, even if they do have a left lean to them. What we're getting from...
Well, go on. No, I was going to say, you know, and this is now a source of disinformation itself, because there are people saying that Ronna Romney McDaniel was fired because she's conservative.
Right.
And, you know, my view on that is, That's not the case. She is. She was fired by NBC because she was an election denier. She referred to January 6th as legitimate political discourse. She talked about the Democrat Party wanting to, steal an election. And so those kinds of things are false and give her a lack of credibility that made her, I think, unsuitable for a television network that wants to have a good reputation. But the spin now is she was fired for being conservative,
right,
which, of course, is not the case. On MSNBC, I happen to know that they have Michael Steele, a former RNC
yes,
chair,
they do.
Who is a host of a show. Nicole Wallace, who is a former Bush White House communications director. David Jolly, a former Republican member of Congress. And so, you know, the idea that she was being silenced because she's conservative is just false. I don't know what NBC was thinking when they hired her with, I suppose in this effort to bring in conservative voices, they were willing to overlook some of the things that she had said in her past. But, to me, it was the right decision to cut ties.
Without a doubt. And I'm glad they did it. But it this is a stain on their reputation because they brought in someone who, as you said, was not just a conservative voice. She was an election denier and she helped propagate this coup attempt, which we now know, really was could be a dress rehearsal. I want to get back to the book because this is all interrelated. Again, we're speaking with Barbara McQuaid. She is a former U.S. attorney. You're a law professor at University of Michigan and a legal voice on MSNBC, where most of us got to know you. And I'm so glad you wrote this book again, because I think disinformation is spread so quickly now. You know, we wouldn't have this problem 30 years ago when the internet wasn't as omnipotent, wasn't everywhere. And it is now. And especially during the pandemic, we had people shut in and finding each other and propelling these conspiracy theories. One chapter five, is The Land of the Free, Why America is Particularly Vulnerable to Disinformation. And I'm guessing, our First Amendment is a big part of it, because you can't be prosecuted for speech, for saying what you believe. We're all entitled to that. We're entitled to peacefully protest. But then there's the distinction of what's peaceful and what isn't. Is making threats against a public official a form of peaceful protest? Because if not, I wonder why there haven't been prosecutions of all the threats.
Yeah, well, actually, there have been a lot of prosecutions of threats. I know the Justice Department just had a big press conference a few days ago to talk about a number of threats that have been prosecuted in Arizona, where there have been a number of threats against public officials.
That just came down, right.
And this topic, Nicole, is such a good one to demonstrate the reason that it is so difficult to hold people accountable in the United States. It is, as I said, our freedoms make us vulnerable in some ways because we care so deeply about free speech and because we care so deeply about an open society. When anyone uses the word censorship, everybody's hackles go up, right? I don't want to be aligned in any way with censorship. Censorship is bad, and censorship is bad.
Yes.
And so we've all been taught that, whether you're on the right or the left, that censorship is a bad thing. And so it sometimes, though, gets weaponized to use the idea that anytime you are trying to stop people from saying something, even if it might be creating a dangerous situation, that is censorship. So you might remember that Merrick Garland testified before Congress a couple of years ago now, when we were seeing this rise in threats during COVID against health officials, against school board officials, for parents who wanted to ban books,
yep,
against election officials, from people who were unhappy with the outcome of the election. And Merrick Garland issued a memo to all the U.S. attorneys in the field urging them to convene their state and local partners and band together to talk about how they were going to address this increase in threats against local public officials. And when he did that, he was dragged before this congressional committee and browbeat for engaging in censorship. You are trying to violate the First Amendment rights of parents and of people who are exercising their First Amendment rights at public meetings to share their viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm not doing anything of the sort. What we're trying to stop is violence. Threats and physical violence is what we are trying to stop. People can express themselves peacefully, but what we're trying to stop is violence. And so that committee tried to use this example to try to demonstrate that this was censorship. And this is the point I'm making of how difficult it can be to protect people when we are seeing this new rise in political violence.
Without a doubt. But then let me read a little bit from the book. You write, after Trump publicly disparaged Judge Tanya Chutkan, who was presiding over his federal election interference case, a Texas woman was charged with threatening to kill Chutkan and her family. Then you go on to talk about Letitia James, and you quote Donald Trump by saying, you ought to go after this AG. Now, that's inciting violence, which we've heard him do at his rallies. Again, say whatever you want, but when you start to exhort people to violence, that's a different animal, isn't it?
Yes, but it's a very difficult line to cross. There is a crime of inciting insurrection. I'll note that Jack Smith did not charge Donald Trump with that crime, despite what we heard as Liz Cheney described it. He called the rioters to Washington. He lit the fuse and then he let it burn. Despite that, he was not charged with inciting insurrection. And I think it's because it is so difficult to cross that legal threshold. There's a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio, where a person was giving a very fiery speech at a KKK rally. And that case worked its way up to the Supreme Court. And what the court held there is that in order for speech to cross a legal line where it can be criminalized, you have to show that the person was inciting imminent lawless action, like right now it's going to happen, that they intended to incite that imminent lawless action, and that their words were likely to have the effect of imminent lawless action. And so although all of us, I think, can see the danger in saying you ought to go after this attorney general, I think a fair argument by a defendant would be to say it hasn't met that standard because he's just calling for this in general terms. Maybe he's talking about going after her in elections and someone should take her on in an election. He hasn't said, right now you ought to, take action. And I intend it to happen right now. And someone is available to take that action right now. So the law sets a very, very high bar, which is why it can be so difficult to overcome. Right. Now, does that mean that this is an okay thing to say? It's not a crime, but it doesn't make it okay. It is still incredibly reckless to call for these kinds of things. When Donald Trump says these things against Letitia James or Judge Engoron in New York or Judge Tanya Chutkan, he knows that in the past, his supporters have engaged in violence. Yep. There's a phrase, and I talk about this in the book, called stochastic terrorism, and it means random. It comes from a Greek word for random, and it means I may not know when or where or who or how, but I know someone's going to take the bait. There's someone unhinged out there who is going to hear my call to action and is going to take the law into their own hands. And so that's the danger of political violence, is that people will engage in vigilantism. I can't trust the courts or the law enforcement to do what I think is right. And so I'm going to take the law into my own hands. Yeah. And so when you have someone like Donald Trump calling for these things, it just doesn't just give license to people to take the law into their own hands. It actually compels some people. Like if you look at the defenses some of those January 6th defendants raised, they said things like, I believe Donald Trump was asking me, my commander-in-chief was calling me to Washington to be a patriot and to exercise my patriotic duty to take our country back. And that's what I did. Now, that defense doesn't fly. Those people are going to jail. But that's what is in the mind of these people. And Donald Trump has to know that. So it's incredibly reckless for him to say these things. And one hopes that voters understand just how reckless it is to put that power in his hands.
Right. Well, there's a section in that chapter, disinformation is sparking violence in America. And I've heard multiple people who I trust, whose judgment I trust, who are warning that this year could get really, really ugly. It's scary out there. You mentioned Arizona. I live in Arizona now. We moved from Florida to get away from that. And just last night or the night before, there was somebody judged guilty and I guess sentenced for this kind of violence at a public meeting. Well, at the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors meeting, they did it again. They showed up in huge numbers, threatening people, making noise, disrupting a government proceeding. So they've learned nothing. And I don't know what the answer is. I just know that people need to be vigilant and stay safe because things may get out of hand this year. And I put it all, I do. It goes back to Trump, who, you know, at the rally at January 6th said, you got to go to the Capitol and you got to fight for our country. We won't have a country anymore. I guess that's open to interpretation what it means. But you know, when you look at some of the groups that were there on January 6th, the Proud Boys and the others who I'm trying to forget, do we not have any laws against domestic terrorism, or are they just, I don't know. There are agents who are supportive of Trump within the government. I don't know if you saw Jason Leopold's report the other day. FOIA documents found that Secret Service and mostly FBI agents who executed the search warrant on Mar-a-Lago were really angry that they had to do this because he's the president. They were letting their personal prejudices and beliefs come in the way. And that's where I think it gets really dangerous. And on January 6th, we saw some police who were not necessarily on the side of law and order.
So to answer your question about domestic terrorism, we really are very limited in the way we prosecute domestic terrorism. And again, it's one of the ways that our freedoms kind of work against us. I think out of an abundance of concern about protecting free speech and free assembly, when people gather and start talking about, you know, plotting, we want to be really sure that they're plotting a crime before we're willing to call it that. And so, you know, one of the things we saw here in my home state of Michigan are these men who plotted to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. And the defense was, well, it was just tough talk. They were just joking and practicing and training, and they didn't actually intend to go through with it. And it's a close call. The first time that case was tried, though, was a hung jury. The case was tried again, and the men were convicted. But I think it's one of the things that can make it very difficult to prosecute cases. Now, the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys were convicted of something called seditious conspiracy.
Right.
And that is another crime that is pretty rarely used because you have to show that the defendants were using or had agreed to use force or violence to prevent the authority of the United States from exercising its legal authority. I think in this case, they were able to do it because they actually crossed the line and physically did engage in violence. It made it actually an easier case, I think. There they are at the Capitol. It's clear that the force they're opposing is the Capitol Police. And through violence, they were trying to stop that certification. So that was an appropriate use of the seditious conspiracy statute because it was this coordinated effort to stop the peaceful transfer of presidential power. It can be much more difficult, though, if you are in an area that the FBI refers to as left of boom. That is, if we're on a timeline and boom is the moment of attack, sometime before the attack is left of boom on that timeline. And so if you're just planning the attack, but you haven't actually gotten there yet, it does leave you open to this defense of, it was just idle chatter, as in the Governor Whitmer case. I think the only reason they were able to stop that, prosecute these men is and women, is because they actually physically showed up and attacked the Capitol. And so could we have laws that are able to help us intercept these kinds of cases earlier in the process? I think there are. If we were willing to pass a domestic terrorism statute that made it a crime to use violence, plan to use violence, attempt to use violence, agree to use violence for a political purpose. But I think our concerns about, you know, free speech, freedom of association, and, you know, political speech makes us very timid about enacting laws like that.
Right. And I think, look, I got to ask your opinion of Merrick Garland, Barb McCoy. Do you think Merrick Garland's doing a good job as Attorney General?
I think he's doing what President Biden asked him to do, which is to restore independence and public confidence in the Department of Justice. And if he had come in on day one and said, I'm going to prosecute Donald Trump, I think there would be a risk that the Justice Department is seen only as the political cudgel of the president. It does concern me that it took a long time, it seems, to get going on the election interference case. You know, we don't know what we don't know. We've seen some reporting about what was going on during that first year. It seems that perhaps they were a little slower than we might like them to have been and not acting with the kind of urgency that we would like, because there is now this risk that this case will not come to trial before the 2024 election. I think there are some people who would say that's not his worry. His job is to hold people accountable. And if somebody becomes there's an election, he's not supposed to think about that. I think I would disagree with that and say that you do have to think about litigation risk. And if someone can come in and can pull the plug on the entire case, that's litigation risk. And so I think you have to be mindful of that when you're building an investigation. And so, looking back retrospectively, it would have been nice to see them start that case with a little more urgency. But I think they failed to anticipate that Donald Trump would come back from the political dead the way he did.
Right. Or that Donald Trump would be Donald Trump, who is a con man at heart. His whole life is a lie. The persona that he played on television in The Apprentice is all, it's reality television, which we know is not reality. But a big part of the American public believes it, and they idolize him for it. When he said, I love the poorly educated, that was, one time he was being honest, because they're easy to lead around. But here's my issue with Merrick Garland, and I don't remember who said it. It wasn't my observation, but it's a good one. Merrick Garland is by the law, straight by the, going by the book, follow the law, be fair. The other side is put your finger on the scale, lie, cheat, and steal your way to win. It's hard to work when you're not dealing on the same level. It's apples and oranges, isn't it?
It is. But I think that if Merrick Garland were to say, the rules are out, I'm going to do whatever it takes to win by any means necessary, then I think we've lost not just the battle, but the war. Right. I think ultimately what we want to do is protect the rule of law. The rule of law is what allows people who are vulnerable to be able to use law to protect ourselves against people who are powerful, whether that's physical power or political power or financial power. The rule of law is what protects us. And so if Merrick Garland were to throw out the rule of law to convict Donald Trump by any means necessary, and I think he's damaged the institution in a way that could be abused by future presidents to our peril.
A perfect point. I agree with you 100%. But then I look at, he appoints Robert Hur to be the special counsel looking over Joe Biden's taking of documents after he left the White House as vice president when his tenure ended. Robert Hur is a Trump acolyte. Couldn't he have picked someone more neutral? I feel like Merrick Garland is a righteous, by the book, law-abiding, law-following attorney general, but he's bending over backwards to show how fair he is by appointing people like Robert Hur who are happy to do Donald Trump's bidding. And I got to ask what you thought of the Hur report.
Yeah, I thought most of it was just fine. He ultimately concluded that Joe Biden should not be prosecuted for any crime. There was no willful violation of the Espionage Act, willful retention of national defense information. I thought he got that decision right. I thought that he did run afoul of the principles of federal prosecution, which say that a prosecutor should refrain from including damaging and inflammatory remarks about someone they're not going to prosecute. And so I thought that it was important to say that he reached the conclusion that Joe Biden could not have willfully violated the law because of things he did not remember. But I thought he went kind of out of his way to then talk about he comes across like an old grandfather who is forgetful. And when you look at the transcript of the interview, that doesn't really seem like a fair description of that interview. And so I did think he went out of his way. I think Merrick Garland could have asked him to redact those lines, but I think Merrick Garland probably appropriately decided, I don't want to be seen as trying to conceal anything that he wrote. I don't want to be seen as trying to put a thumb on the scale. This is what he wrote. I appointed him. There's nothing illegal about that. There's nothing private about that. I'm going to let it go. Let the chips fall where they may. So I don't know that this was a hatchet job. I think if it were really a hatchet job, he would have recommended charges against Joe Biden because the case would not have come to trial before the election. And he'd have this indictment hanging out there, which Trump could use to neutralize his own indictment and say, see, everybody does it. Everybody's corrupt. So I think, he cleared him of wrongfulness. He did, criticize him for his memory, but I think it's a minor minor violation of the rules of the principles of federal prosecution. I don't think he was necessarily in the bag for Donald Trump. And one thing that I think this decision, which I think is the right decision based on the facts in that report, enables Joe Biden to do is to draw a distinction between himself and Donald Trump. In the very first page of that report, Robert Hur goes out of his way to explain why this case is different from the case of Donald Trump, that Donald Trump engaged in obstruction of the investigation, which is really the main reason that he is being charged, that when alerted that he had these documents and that they belong to the National Archives, Trump refused to turn them over, in contrast to Joe Biden, who immediately turned them over and invited the FBI in to look for anything he might have missed, disclose them, return them. Instead, what Donald Trump did is lie about them, obstruct them, and encourage other people to help him in this obstruction, including his own lawyer. And so I think if someone were in the bag for Donald Trump, they would not have disclosed that. Because one of the strategies of disinformation of authoritarians, and in particular Vladimir Putin, is to convince you not that the leader is innocent and that the leader is honest. It's to convince you that everyone else is dishonest.
Right.
Because if everyone is corrupt, then corruption doesn't matter. And you might as well vote for the person who shares your values or is the strongest or will make you the most prosperous, because honesty and integrity is for suckers. Or if you're someone who does care about honesty and integrity, I'm going to dirty up the other guy so that you become cynical and you believe everybody's corrupt and you disengage from politics altogether because you say they're all a bunch of crooks and I don't want anything to do with them. And so that's the effort that Donald Trump and his supporters are trying to use to portray Joe Biden as someone who's done the same thing as Donald Trump. And so I give Robert Hur credit for making it clear on page one of his report how very different these two cases are.
I got you on that. There were little things like that Eric Swalwell pointed out during the hearing that at one point in the transcript, you say to Joe Biden, you have like a photographic recall of all these facts. And he said it a couple of times, but it appears nowhere in the final report. Instead, he's a doddering old man who will be sympathetic to the jury because he's, you know, senile. It just that. But then you look at, okay, so we talked Merrick Garland, who is the epitome of fairness by the book, follow the law, the letter of the law. Now look at Bill Barr, who it was his second time as attorney general. I don't think he was like this the first time. And boy, he went from one extreme to almost the other while he was Donald Trump's attorney general. But you look at what he did with the release of the Mueller report, where he held on to it and released his own interpretation of it in a short synopsis that was anything but representative of what was in the report. So, right? That's disinformation.
Yes, I think William Barr was a shameful attorney general. You know, regardless of politics and policy, certainly an attorney general is entitled to have their own vision of the job, to set priorities and decide how the law will be used. But what William Barr did during his time as attorney general, I think, is really shameful, and I think really undermined public confidence in the Department of Justice, which is why I think Merrick Garland has worked so hard to try to restore those principles to the department. You know, when I worked there, I was told repeatedly throughout my tenure, I worked in the Clinton administration, the George W. Bush administration, the Obama administration, and for a smidge, the Trump administration. And, you know, at all times, the goal was to avoid politics whatsoever and to focus on the facts and the law in any case. But in addition to the Mueller report, which I'll talk about in a minute, William Barr also, don't forget, dismissed the charges against Michael Flynn, who lied to the FBI about the fact that he had had conversations with the ambassador to Russia during the transition period and really undercut President Obama's sanctions against Russia for election interference, saying, don't worry about it, don't retaliate, we'll get rid of him when we come into office. That was a really serious crime. And William Barr came in and said, and to which Michael Flynn had entered a guilty plea, by the way. He tried to withdraw his guilty plea, but the judge wasn't having it. And so William Barr came in and said, there's no evidence of materiality, which means that this mattered and was important. So we're going to dismiss this. That's hogwash. It was absolutely material. It absolutely meets the legal standard of materiality. The other thing that he did was he had ordered the U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., who was an appointee who came in temporarily at the behest of the attorney general, to file a new sentencing memo after the career prosecutors in the Roger Stone case. So the Roger Stone, remember, he lied, he was convicted of lying to Congress about his role in connections with Russia and the Trump campaign, convicted of those crimes. And when the career prosecutors gave their recommendation for what the sentence ought to be, William Barr ordered that that sentencing memo be withdrawn and a different one be submitted, asking for a lower penalty in that case. And so that was another example, I think, of, although the attorney general always has the power to do that, a complete abuse of that power to step in to do Donald Trump's bidding. And then, of course, let's turn to the Mueller report. So yes, there's an independent counsel, Robert Mueller, whose job is to investigate this case. He submits his report, including an executive summary that is designed to be shared with the public. And William Barr engages in something I discussed in the book called reflexive control. And that is, I'm going to control the message in a way because I know how you're going to react. And so if I push here, you're going to react in a certain way. And he knew what he was doing because he gave his spin of the report weeks before the report actually came out. And he said it was a complete exoneration, that all this money had been spent, all this time, all these witnesses, all these records. And there was, you know, no conspiracy, no collusion, end of story. He also said that Robert Mueller could not reach a conclusion about obstruction. So he himself, William Barr, did and found no obstruction of justice. So it's all over, end of story. Well, he knows that by the time this real report really comes out and weeks have passed, the media and the public will have moved on to other things.
Right.
Because he knows that we have short attention spans in this society.
That's right.
And that if he can control the narrative, people will make up their mind, they will form a first impression, and they will move on by the time the real facts are laid out. And we know that a federal judge, Reggie Walton, later said that what William Barr said was a distortion, it was misleading. And even Robert Mueller himself, a stoic soldier of a prosecutor, wrote a letter to William Barr saying that he was concerned that that William Barr's announcement had misled the public about what was in his report. And so it was, I think, a deliberate effort to bury what was really in Robert Mueller's report and its executive summary.
Absolutely. And so and you think, okay, that's about as low as you could go. Then after Barr leaves, because I guess it even got too much for his integrity, Jeffrey Clark, I mean, the people that Donald Trump installed, and I guess he's talking about it could be the future attorney general. This guy was unqualified. This is what we're learning, is if Trump somehow gets back in, and I have no illusions that he'll actually win legitimately, but I think they're going to take all the lessons they learned from trying to steal it last time, all the while saying that the other side is trying to steal it. Projection. So they could get back in, and he's already let it be known what he would do. That's not disinformation. That's real. But we're having a hard time getting that message across, it seems.
Yes, I think if Donald Trump is reelected, there are going to be some very serious concerns about the Justice Department and other career professionals. So one of the things Donald Trump has said he learned at the end of his administration, that he loves actings, because acting cabinet officials do not have to be confirmed.
Right.
And so one of the checks we have on presidential power is the advice and consent of the Senate. And so if somebody has to be confirmed, that could keep somebody out of the cabinet who has the baggage of a Jeffrey Clark or a Rudy Giuliani or someone else who might not be trustworthy in that role. But if he can appoint actings, there are some time limits on it. And he can do a series of acting attorneys general or other people who are willing to do his bidding. You know, at the end of his administration, he did this at the Defense Department, putting people in who were his loyalists. So we could see that. The other thing he's promised to do is to impose Schedule F of the Civil Service Code. This was something that he created at the end of the first administration. Joe Biden quickly rescinded it, but he would impose it again. And it would affect up to 50,000 of our career professionals in the civil service and make them replaceable by political appointees. I mean, there are so many people who are career scientists and doctors, people
right.
working at the CDC or the EPA, people, you know, taking care of our nuclear arsenal,
right.
Working on the energy grid. And, you know, these are professionals. If instead you put into all of these positions people who wish for political reasons, it could be really disastrous for us. So there are a lot of reasons I'm very concerned about a second Trump administration.
It's an understatement. I mean, it's the ultimate disinformation. Look what they did to Dr. Fauci. And again, mm-hmm. the projection that they employ, they talk about the deep state as if these career professionals are something to fear. It's okay with them if they are MAGA sympathizers. Then you have all the deep state people you want. Just anybody who doesn't agree with his worldview is a traitor, is an enemy of the state, is his enemy, which is a complete difference from Joe Biden, who says, I'm everybody's president. Even if you didn't vote for me, if you don't like me, it's okay. I still represent you. So that's dangerous. So we talked about, Barbara, the disinformation coming through, you know, the media and even the spread through the internet. Social media is one of the big problems, and the lack of accountability there. There's something called Section 230, which basically gives these big companies a pass on moderating. Can you explain what Section 230 is and where we are on having that done away with?
Yes. So Section 230 is part of the Telecommunications Decency Act of 1996.
Yep.
So if you can remember where we were in 1996, people were generally not on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Internet email was, you know, about as sophisticated as it got. And, most of us, there was not really any sort of Facebook or Twitter or any of those things at that time. But Section 230 was designed to promote innovation. And so the idea was, if you were an internet pioneer and you had to worry about the content that was placed there by other people, it might inhibit innovation and creativity and the kinds of things we wanted to encourage. And so if you read that section, it actually almost reads like, you know, a children's novel. It talks about the potential of the internet, what a great thing it's going to be. It's going to connect people from all over the world and help us solve problems together. It's a wonderful thing. And it has done that.
Mm-hmm.
But now here we are 30 years later, and we see some of the problems that have arisen as a result of disinformation on social media and all the ways that it can be used. And it's time, I think, to rethink that. It doesn't mean it has to be an all or nothing solution. We don't have to completely get rid of it. But I do think there are things that we need to do to address it. So, you know, just some examples. In one of the things I assigned my national security students to read about disinformation is Robert Mueller's report, and not the stuff about Trump, but the stuff about Russia, because it talks about how Russian disinformation online influenced the outcome of the election.
Sure.
He talks about how Russian operatives set up lots and lots of social media accounts on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and others, and they made it look like they were real Americans.
Yeah.
And they picked every group they could find. So there was one called Blacktivist that looked like a Black political activist who said very reasonable mainstream things that many African-Americans would agree with. There was one for coal miners. There was one for Christians. There were more than one. There was something called United Muslims of America. There's something called Tennessee GOP. There's something called Heart of Texas. And so people thought that these were members of their own affinity groups.
Huh?
And so they joined and they followed and they engaged and exchanged messages. But then as we get close to the election, this is where they started pushing the election interference. And so there was one that went out to the Christian groups where Jesus is arm wrestling the devil and said, if Hillary wins, Jesus, the devil wins. So that was designed to appeal to Christians.
Right.
There was another one that went out to the Blacktivist group that said, Hillary Clinton is taking our community for granted. We should send her a message that we should not be ignored. The way we can best assert our political power is by staying home on Election Day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we'll never know how many people took that advice, but if even a few people took it in a swing state that was decided by a narrow margin, that could have had an impact on that. And so, so anonymous accounts online, I think, are one of the things that are driving disinformation. Couldn't we require verified account users? I think that's one thing. We know from the Facebook whistleblower, Francis Haugen, that Facebook was creating algorithms designed to push content that would most outrage us.
That's right.
Because that would keep us online, that would make us look at ads, and that would bring more money for Facebook. And so couldn't we have prohibitions on algorithms designed to generate outrage? So I think there are tweaks we can do that would make certain aspects of their behavior illegal without regulating content, but could have the effect and the impact of reducing disinformation online.
Yeah, we're coming up to the end of the hour, Barbara McQuaid, and I could keep talking to you forever. This is fascinating. I so appreciate you being here. what other than, yes, fixing Section 230. By the way, who's standing in the way of that? Because there have been efforts and it keeps getting shut down, right?
Yeah, I think it's the tech companies themselves, which have powerful lobbies. And I also think it is the confusion of the members of Congress who aren't quite sure how to get their arms around it. But I think if they have the political will, it can be done. You know, they hire experts all the time to work through difficult and challenging things, right? They regulate space satellites, and we've put a man on the moon. So we can do hard things. We could do this too. If
we can. So then the last question is, what else can we do? I mean, my mantra to anyone who comes at me with some outlandish story is, consider the source. What is the source? If it's from some blog that you never heard of before and you can't find it backed up anywhere, then chances are it's not real. Warning, but that's what else can we do to counter
this? Yeah, so I hate to focus on blaming the consumer, because the real wrongdoers here are the people who are pushing disinformation online. And so in the book, I have a number of solutions, and many of them are directed at the supply of disinformation and regulating that. But there are some things we can do on our own end, on sort of the demand end. One of them, I think, is teaching in schools the idea of media literacy, as you just said, not relying solely on the headline, which doesn't always reflect what's in the story. Looking for a second source. If it's big news, it'll be reported elsewhere.
Right.
Looking for data. If there is some study that's reported, what was the sample size? Was it 2 million or was it 2? Like,
yes.
That makes a big difference. Understanding the difference between causation and correlation. So I think those are some things we can do. But I think, Nicole, the most important thing we can do right now is demanding truth ourselves. I think we've become so polarized, and that is a function of this deliberate effort to push us apart through disinformation. But because we are so polarized, we're so mad at each other that we are willing to go along with the con sometimes when we believe it favors our side, or we're willing to accept facts because we are so blinded by our anger at the other side that we'll do whatever it takes to win. And I think we have to resist that temptation. We have to demand truth. We have to demand facts. We can't choose tribe over truth. And if all of us do that, demand facts, then I think we will end up getting, instead of the leaders we currently have, the leaders that we really deserve.
Oh, I hope you are right. I've never wanted anything more. I'm truly terrified about what's coming this year. I hope my small little part is trying to talk sense to people, and whoever listens, maybe they'll think twice before they go off on a tangent, although I've been known to do that too. So, but I try to always speak truth. And if I'm wrong, I admit that I'm wrong. I love being corrected. So we all need to embrace a little bit more of that, search out the truth and stop the disinformation and call it out where we see it. Barbara McQuaid, your book is a real service. Again, it's Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. So I thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Nicole. It was a pleasure to join you.
You too. Thank you. All right. With that, we are done. That is a Wednesday for us. Tomorrow, Thursday, Howie Klein will be here. And Marcy Wheeler, of course, is here on Fridays. She, her birthday's coming up, and she's going to take a little mini vacation. But this is how dedicated we are. We are going to tape a segment for Friday tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. my time. So I guess I need to do some more work on the studio tonight so that it works. For the most part, I'm looking at the chat room now. For the most part, we did okay. We had a few buffering moments where we almost lost her. But technically, how did it sound, chatters? You know what? Do me a favor. If you listen, let me know. Email me, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com. And it doesn't, not only about this, you can email me about anything, anytime. I read my emails. I respond to most. As you know, I have nobody else. I have no producer or anybody working for me. When I joke about firing my producer because she's doing a shitty job, I'm talking about myself. It is a one woman band here. Although the audio has been fine all the way through. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm thrilled that Barbara McQuaid came on. The book is great. I appreciate Spocko's help because things have been hectic the last little while. He gave me some good pointers. But it's such a big topic. It's hard to, hone it all down. Anyway, I hope I did you proud. Tomorrow, again, Howie Klein. Friday, it will be Marcy Wheeler. And boy, does she have a lot to say about the Ronna, not Romney McDaniel thing. And she makes a really good point. So I'll be sure to address that with her. All right. With that, we're done. I'm exhausted. So I'm gonna fump for around in my studio a little more and see if I can't figure out why the signal goes bad. But that's my problem, not yours. Thank you for listening. I'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Peace out.